I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the London Review Bookshop. It's a real pleasure to welcome Ian Penman and Adam Mars-Jones this evening. Adam is a renowned novelist and critic. His most recent novel, Batlava Lake, is from Fitzcarraldo. Before that, Box Hill. And before that, in 2019, his collected film journalism from Reaction, Second Sight, a beautiful piece of kit. He is also, like Ian, much beloved contributor to the LRB, whose pieces are one of the things that if you see the name in the contributors list, it's one of the first things worth turning to. Ian is the author of It Gets Me Home, This Curving Track, marvellous collection of essays on music, many of which have been previously printed in the LRB, which we launched in a raucous party in 2019 in this very shop.
The last party before COVID, basically.
It was pretty much. It was pretty much, and I remember it well, with a mix of gladness and melancholy. And it's a joy to have the pair of them back to launch Fassbinder, Thousands of Mirrors, Ian's most recent book from Fitzcarraldo. Welcome, Ian. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
You might not guess from what's just been said that Ian and I have never met before.
No.
So all we've done is carefully not talk about what we're about to talk about. Oh. But there's a biographer called Roger Lewis who started writing about
Anthony Burgess,
and as a Rabbit fan, and ended up loathing him pretty much. You haven't done that, but you've done a sort of micro Lewis. There's an element that you're exorcising at the same time as trying to defend Fassbinder. How did that come about?
There's two aspects to that. One is, yes, there was. I loved him when I was younger, when I was in my 20s, and I thought it'd be interesting to see how I felt about him now. And of course, I think it's natural your feelings would be very different, as it would be about, you know, rebellious rock stars or, you know, TV stars from the 70s who you subsequently discover weren't paragons of virtue. But writing the book, yes, there's a lot about how I don't think he was a perfect person or anything, but there's also an aspect where I think I admire him even more. I think it's stunning what he managed to do. Because I've learned from, you know, as we all learn growing up, if you work in the arts, it's very difficult to get anything done, to get a personal project done, especially on someone else's money, especially in film and TV. And here was someone who just rode a truck through that and just got all this stuff done, who didn't accept no for an answer, who just got an immense amount of things done.
I mean, I think the figure you give is a film completed every 100 days. And when I read that, I thought, typo, but it's not.
Not just films. TV as well,
so that's
theatre as well, interviews as well, kind of political life as well, you know, and had a very busy leisure life as well, shall we say. So he, you know, he did everything at full throttle. Admittedly, he did die young, but I think I don't see why biographies shouldn't have these ambivalent feelings.
Oh, no.
I don't see why you shouldn't. And I always felt slightly uneasy about people writing about Fassbinder when the people who knew that his personal life was full of contradictions and cruelties and, you know. So I don't think you should ignore that. But at the same time, you know, you can't kind of, you can't gainsay what he achieved. And I think that's an interesting tension in the current world in which we inhabit, where everyone is either cancelled or kind of a model of virtue. To me, it's interesting that someone could be both those things. And it's especially interesting, someone like him who was kind of... is very much a kind of radical figure, loathed by the right and so on. And although, you know, not uniformly popular with the left either, but who was a kind of really industrious. In some ways, he's the model citizen because he set out to do things and he did them, you know. So it's like he didn't in his films, he blames everything on the capitalist system, basically. He basically says there's no hope, that, you know, all our relationships are poisons in advance by capitalism. Nothing good can come of it. And yet he was the ideal capitalist in a lot of ways. In some ways, you know, he was the ideal worker, you know, although you'd have to define and redefine what work and labour means in that sense, in the art world. He was someone who did this immense amount of stuff while saying... it would be impossible to do this immense amount of stuff because capitalism is set up to deny people like me to do stuff like this. So it's just a really interesting tension at the heart of his life, I think.
And the single most surprising fact to me was that he'd been to a Steiner school, because to me the idea of little Rainer with a wooden block with no corners working away is just very hard to imagine that he wouldn't pick it up and try to chip somebody with it. But you feel that that is not, you know, that is part of his
that
branding.
Was a turning point, I think, the Steiner school, because he'd been to seven or eight schools before that and all been disastrous. And I think the reason the Steiner school was worked was because they let him do what he wanted. And it's kind of I wonder if he didn't suffer from attention deficit disorder, because even if you read about his childhood, even then he was doing 12 things at once. Admittedly, you know, he was actually achieving, he would finish them, he would finish projects, but he was always, even when he was a child, he was doing three or four things at once and kind of, you know. So, I don't know. And again, that makes me wonder if today he would be identified and given drugs for that and, you know, would identify as this and would that would alter his behaviour, whereas back then he just went straight ahead and did it without worrying if this was what was causing this, you know. It's like, so it's a slight question about identity politics, you know. It's like, I identify as this. I don't think he identified as anything except himself and just kind of drove a cart and horse through everything. And you have to say, even if you don't like his films, you have to say he really achieved an immense amount by, you know, just an astonishing, just what he finished and did.
I'm what, 5 years older than you? So I think I saw Theory to Soul when it came out. And was very struck with it, but had never seen a Douglas Sirk film. So I didn't know the, not exactly formula, but the set of conventions that he was re-manipulating. And then I saw Bitterteer's Petra von Kant, which I loved and was very different. Never quite got the pleasure from later ones that I did from those, I think, earlier on. Because the man is wolf to man idea, it's a theorem that you only need to prove once. Because it is a theorem, and it's there in other works of art. It's there in something like Visconti's The Damned in a very different, more florid style. But it is a dead end as a dramatic, you know, it doesn't extend your dramatic palette. Do you think there's a repetitiveness of theme that undermines...
Yeah, that's the main problem I have with it, I think, is that... I can't remember what the exact quote is, but he's a great theorist of poisons, but not of cures. And he proves over and over again that everything is a dead end. I mean, the earliest film, Love is Colder Than Death, is like he just thinks there's no hope, no chance. And, you know, when I first came across his films, when I was like 16, 17, 18, 19, that's quite attractive. And you think, yeah, that's right. That's what society's like. Fucking right, Rayner.
Why don't I have a girlfriend?
You know, yep. But if you end up, you know, having a... And he didn't have a long life. So I think my question would be, how much can we trust? Would he have changed? It's pointless asking, but he didn't have, you know, a lot of experience of that thing where you grow through life and, you know, learn that there are all kinds of shades to these things. So I think looking, it is a problem that I think almost every film is hopeless. I mean, there's a list in the book of how films end, and they end with people dead, basically. And that's, you know, the happy ones.
Well, at least, yeah. It's at like, least then you know it's over.
It's spiritual death or physical death or political death or, you know, and it is a problem. And it was, even at the time, he did have his critics saying, well, you know, why are your, especially gay critics, I think, at the time said, well, you know, it's like you're not showing any hope.
I felt that personally when I saw Fox and His Friends from about 1976 or something like that, where I thought, well, if we're no different, why represent us at all? Because it was so unusual to have a representation that to have everything immediately ground down to the same powder was depressing. And there aren't moments, the closest I can think of to a moment when the worm turns, you know, when the apparently weak gets the upper hand, which at least is a variation on the Givens, is the moment in Bitter Tears of Petrov and Kant where the slave, who's been treated as nothing, does it mute completely, doesn't speak at all, or I can't remember?
Well, although he actually said that she doesn't turn. He says that...
And we should explain what the context is.
She leaves this relationship, and you could read the film as she's had enough. I'm not taking this anymore. I'm going off to find my freedom and my desires. He actually says no. She'll go off and find it exactly... the reason she's leaving is because the other showed her a tiny bit of recognition.
Oh, no, that is how I read it, I must admit. But
she's going off to find exactly the same relationship somewhere else.
Only with the proper sadist who doesn't have second
films,
thought.
I agree with you, those two films, that they're problematic because on the one hand, you know, they are kind of... they're not showing a great representation. On the other hand, they're full of class, which I think a lot of films at the time weren't. They're very much, you know, it's like, especially Fox and His Friends, where you have the middle class who take up this, you know, working class guy, and he's completely lost. He loses through that. But and these things, you know, what I'm saying isn't new. A lot of people said that in the 70s, I think, about his films.
I did feel it.
But I like that. I actually like that aspect of his films, that quality, that it's not settled, you know, but...
It's not settled. You mean that there are still options?
Well, not settled in the sense that I mean there are programmatic aspects to it, but it's kind of I like the fact that he does that you can come out of the film's feeling that this aspect of these relationships is kind of something you can work off. I don't know. Yeah.
One of the things you say in the book is that you chose him as a role model precisely because he was so unsuited to it. If you wanted a role model who would show you, who would not moralise, who would not tell you how to behave in a certain way, who would inspire you but not make things, not give you lights to follow, as it were.
Well, I think choose is probably overstating it. I mean, again, I think, you know, when you're young like that, these things are attractive for various reasons. And they seem to have a truth at the time, which, you know, is subsequently not necessarily proved by life. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was very attractive at the time. And do I still think it's attractive? I don't know. That's what the book was partly about. It was, because for years I've been telling people, you know, in drunken conversations, I'd say, Fassbinder changed my life. You know, it's like, and then 3 years ago, someone finally said to me, "What do you mean by that? What do you mean? You keep saying this," and I had to actually And I suddenly, I couldn't actually answer, you know. It was kind of, and it was true. But I had to start thinking, did he change it for good or bad or, you know.
It was like, also a sort of, it was part of a constellation of influences.
Yeah.
Some which involved rejection of a particularly parochial view of culture and politics.
In the late 70s, mid, just to remember the UK, you know, what was the, you know, TV, film, literature, there were there was nothing exciting, you know, I mean, like, we'd had punk and music, so there's this kind of, you know, rousing aspect of that. But I loved film and I loved literature, and I wanted, you know, this reflection somewhere. And I found it in French books and German films, partly. And I couldn't have articulated it at the time, I think. I mean, for instance, the French books, I think, you know, Derrida and Barthes and everything, be easy to say why I love them because I think I love them partly because how they looked. And it was like, you know, just looking at the pages, the use of white space, you know, how different they looked from British novels at the time, you know. At the time I thought, it's like Martin Amis's second novel. Is that the most exciting thing in the world, really? You know, and then you come across Roland Barthes and Derrida and Julia Kristeva. No, this is more exciting. You know?
Not the novelists, though. The French novelists didn't particularly...
Subsequently, yeah. But at the time, it was more... no, it was more the theory stuff, but... Yeah.
You mentioned what should have been Fassbinder's monument, which is the 15-hour Berlin Alexanderplatz, and you're not a huge fan of it, nor am I, having been given it as a Christmas present by my partner. And we sat down to watch an episode every evening, and then one of us said, and I'm not saying it wasn't me, said, why don't we have an episode of Berlin Alexanderplatz and an episode of Battlestar Galactica? And so we did that for a while, and then somehow the Fassbinder never found its way out of the box after that. So 15 hours. And he wanted to remake it. Was it with John Malkovich? Was there a suggestion?
No, it was... was it French actor? I can't remember. It doesn't... I think it shoots itself in the foot, partly because it doesn't get off to a great start. The first couple of episodes don't kind of draw you in.
3 hours?
Two and a half hours? I think it does work. I think... if you can get into it, it does subsequently become really hypnotic. But I think the first, and again, I say in the book, during lockdown, I thought, right, I'm going to write this book. I'm going to look at all these old Fassbinder films. And I started with Berlin Alexanderplatz, and it was a disaster because it's like you're locked in a room, you can't go out, you know, with COVID. And then you're watching a film which people are locked in a room and can't go out and scream at each other. We're here forever. We're going to murder each other. And it was just, no. It's like, but it does, I mean, people like Susan Sontag wrote about it and said it was this huge achievement. And that was the thing. I think it's more like Visconti and Antonioni, that kind of congealed kind of film as art thing. And I thought Fassbinder was better than that, was more punky. I think he worked better as a kind of punchy, you know, oh, you don't like this one? Another one will be along in a couple of months, you know. It's like, you know. And I think he'd been thinking about Berlin Alexanderplatz for his whole life almost. And then it was also, it's problematic because it's also the German establishment welcomed him. It's like German TV money saying, right, do this. And I think even formally it doesn't work because he shot it like a film, but at TV it looks really dark. Mm. It literally looks really dark and small and claustrophobic. He seemed to, I don't know, he had such a personal reading of it that if you read the book is a wonderful book. And it's like a great modernist. It's like Ulysses in Berlin. It's like the city is just jumping with life, jumping with headlines and noise and people and politics. And the film doesn't really capture that.
capture that, I don't think.
Of that generation of German filmmakers, the film that probably most affected me was Enigma of Caspar Hauser. And I remember being told by a friend who was whose mother was German, he was saying, in German romanticism, the grotesque is an aspect of the sublime. And I thought, now I understand why there are grotesque things that I'm not meant to laugh at, because these people can't, you know, something like Heart of Glass, you think, does he not see that there's something funny in here somewhere? But
there is a problem there.
Well, no, but I mean, I think it's a real point that we think that humour is outside culture, but it's clearly strongly determined by culture. And the idea that there are certain things which are the sublime in disguise rather than intended to make you roll about, which was really interesting. But of that generation, you make the point very strongly that he was the least conscious of nature, the least aware of any possibility
sublime.
Other than,
yeah.
Yes, of the sublime as a place that you might visit on a tram if need be. You say is there one picture of Fassbinder in the open air, pretty much?
Early on, yeah. Even then, he's
trying to turn it into a small city.
He's got his leather jacket on, and it's like he's hitchhiking to get out of there as soon as possible.
But it is unusual culturally to have that.
And again, that was why I liked it at the time, because I was, 17 years old, and I'd come to London, and I thought the city was where I was at. It was at, and so, but again, later on we discover the sublime and rediscover. I mean, I grew up at that time in Norfolk, which I hated, loathed. And, but, 20 years later, you rediscover locales and places and you rediscover what's good about them and so on. And that is the problem, I think, with Fassbinder, is that it's the best thing about him and the worst. It's like he gives an absolutely perfect picture of young people in the city tearing each other apart. And the unanswerable question is, what would it have been like if he'd lived? Mm. I think. Like, I mentioned Genet in the book, because I think that's very similar in a lot of ways, because Genet had the early style, which was very much quite repetitive, and his obsessions, But Genet ended up having like three or four different lives. Astonishing life, because he had these. He escaped from each box he was put in, and subsequently, embraced politics and embraced. It became almost fatherly in his later life, and absolutely, the value of love and revolution and everything. And could that have happened with Fassbinder? It's impossible to say, but
I mean, Genet and Bowie are the examples you give of people who've lived successive lives, but Fassbinder does seem to be very much digging his own trench as he goes along.
Yeah, but he did die young, so it's hard to say.
I mean, he did see to that. I mean, seemingly,
he did
take care of that. The town you hated, I think you mentioned had three cinemas and a cinema club. So that is like, a dark city with an awful lot of green spaces in it. was that your first exposure to films? Or?
Not really. I don't know. I think my first exposure was the thing that determined everything in my life. Was
another book?
It's in the mid-60s. I was in an RAF family and we were in Cyprus. And there was a cinema in Limassol that was literally, it was like an amphitheatre. It was an open-air cinema. And I remember we went to see Cape Fear with Robert Mitchum. And I must have been about six or seven at the time, but it was an X, Cape Fear.
Yeah.
Remember X's?
It's a scary film. It's pretty
and
intense.
It is scary. It's very adult. And at a certain point in it, my dad, my Protestant dad, reached over and put his hand over and... Now, this is like a Lacanian diagram. If you want someone to be obsessed with cinema and looking in images, what do? You do that. You stop them seeing what you're supposed to see. It's like a Freudian Lacanian diagram. And I've often thought that's it. That was when it happened.
I had a similar...
The only other film we saw was Move Over, Darling, with Rock Hudson and Doris Day. But I don't think that had quite the...
But I have read an academic article that indicates by analysis of the bachelor pad that Rock Hudson is living in that everybody knew he was gay, that it's coded gay very clearly. So perhaps somebody in that audience got that message and decided that their curtains betrayed them or something. The similar moment I had to your father's hands over your face was I was taken by a friend of the family, elderly and very deaf, so she would tend to say, I don't think much of that hat. she was a liability, but she took me to Lord Jim, the Peter O'Toole firm, and at a certain stage she realised he was going to die. And so we left, so I couldn't see him die. Which made it far more interesting than it actually...
Peter O'Toole did die, didn't
well,
he?
Well, yeah, I had worked that out before tonight. The internet is
no,
good
no,
for
I mean,
something.
Actual Peter O'Toole.
Oh, yeah, I mean, not on set. No, it was to shield me from trauma.
Yeah.
But the shielding
but,
from
yeah,
trauma
makes
was
it worse. Yeah.
Much, much, much worse.
No, but to go back to... I do think it's interesting that the small town I live now... and it's not that small, it's, you know, it's like, but has no cinemas. But the dull small town that I lived in the 70s had three cinemas and a cinema society. And the cinema society was, you know, showed things like Death in Venice. And the main cinemas, you know, showed things like Taxi Driver and Jaws and everything. Mm. But they were, you know, absolutely, it could support that. But now I don't think most towns have cinemas, do they? I don't know. But it's either online or I don't know.
First time I saw Lawrence of Arabia was at a film society. And it took me quite a long time. It's a long film, but it took me a long time to realise that they were... that the image was too big for the screen and they were constantly moving the...
Yeah.
So you think, why am I seeing so much sand? I mean, I know there's a lot of sand, but shouldn't there be a person somewhere in the sand? Oh, there he is. Because they were desperately...
Well, there are shots in that film
yes,
where it's the whole
I
point. Isn't
I know,
it? Yeah.
I know.
But I do. There's a serious point under all that, which is, I think, we part of the first few generations where, had film and TV... that were kind of, you know, and film was, you know, and TV. I started writing the book and I realised I'd seen all these things when I was fairly young. And I do think, I used to think this about, I already had this theory about music, which is like being 11 or something and hearing Roxy Music for the first time. I think it's like a seduction in the Freudian sense, is that you're seduced by an adult and your knowledge of things you can have no knowledge about. And it's partly the reason that you're so into Bowie or Roxy Music, but it's also the reason you can't recover. I do think it is slightly, it's almost like, I wouldn't say abuse, but it's like, you know, you are very young and you'll be given this vision of the world that you can't possibly understand and you may have to spend the rest of your life working out. And I think film and TV were a bit like that, which is... why I put in the book stuff about seeing Auschwitz footage when I was six or something on the TV, just sitting there playing with your Lego and you look up and you see this stunning, you know. And I can still see it in my mind's eye, you know. It's like, so I think there is a whole thing there to do with images and how we interact with them and delivery systems and so on.
But as the delivery systems have changed so much, do you think it would be possible to be so obsessed with a single set of artists or images, or would you be led down rabbit hole after rabbit hole and end up diffusing the impact of those first things? Do you think that the force with which these things hit you is not reproducible now?
Yeah, I don't think they just hit me. I think it was, no. You know, our generations. I think it was, you know, you would see these things and they had incredible power, I think, you know. And that was the thing I'm, you know, writing about Baudelaire or Bowie. Or so. People say, with Bowie, they never say, I heard him first. They always say, I saw him on Top of the Pops. I saw him with his arm around, you know. I saw him. It's like, it was like this thing, tea time, family scene, TV, you know, intimacy. And then you have this image beamed in. From where? Where has this image come from? An image that no one can have any you can't have predicted this image, you know. And then all of a sudden, you're all sitting there looking at this image, you know. And your father goes that, you know, like, but no.
He did that to Bowie too.
No. He should have done. But it is like that. I think that's why, you know. It's like, because they had this incredible power, I think. But now we live in a world that is all images, you know. It's like everything. And I'm not sure that, you know. It's something that's partly, I mean, when I wrote about a piece about Baudelaire recently for the LRB, I thought about that too, about how, who were the first people to be photographed? Who were the first people who had kind of rock star images? And it was Sarti and Alfred Jarry and Charles Baudelaire and so on. They were the first people to have an image. And Rambo, of course. And we're still obsessed by them. Those images still have an incredible power, just as Bowie still has an incredible power and Robert Mitchum still does, you know. I think they still have... Why? Why should that be when we're now living in a world that's inundated with images? Why should these images from a long time ago still have this real power? And that applies to Fassbinder's best work as
but
well.
It may be that those photographs gave them more power than it took away, whereas, I mean, when Charles Chaplin was the most famous person on earth, he could just smear off the moustache and go out in the street. When the Beatles were the most famous people on earth, they could still take a holiday on an island. But now nobody can get away from the drone, yeah. from the phone. So the sense that it is impossible to control an image, it may be that Bowie was one of the last people to be able to so comprehensively radiate the images he wanted, because there are very few pictures of him that he didn't authorise or wouldn't have.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think that's a problem with Fassbinder. And again, that's one of the reasons I love Jeunet, is because he escaped from it. He escaped from his image. And I think Fassbinder didn't, and other examples, Serge Gainsbourg, or there are people, and even Baudelaire, didn't escape from your image. You become this image. And I think it can literally kill people in that sense, I think.
There was a lovely quote you have from Fassbinder where he says he wants to be on the cover of Time.
Ugly on the cover of Time. My favourite quote of all time.
That's really strong, because it does suggest he did have the sense that he could escape on the Blake principle of, you know, if the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise. If you persist in your ugliness, you'll become
useful. I think that's partly drug addict illusion, delusion. One of his friends made a documentary on him in the last days, The Wizard of Babylon, and which is subsequently his mother and the foundation have subsequently sued them and taken the footage out. But there was footage of Fassbinder looking ugly and really drugged and really drunk and a mess. And it's not a good thing, I don't think. I think his idea that you could be ugly on the cover of Time was that it would be splendid and sublime. Mm-hmm. But I think it rarely looks sublime. I think it looks ugly and messy and, you know, I don't know. At the time, you know, in the 1980s, I would have said he was a hero for this stuff. But again, come back to, you know, if you don't die young and you look back on it, do you think it's wonderful? Mm, I'm not sure. Is it a recipe for a great life?
I mean, he worked with the same people so much of the time. That must have been a sort of substitute family. And you've noticed the way they often work together even without Fassbinder, or that he might appear in something and bring them along to make sure they got work when he wasn't there. So that seems as close to a nurturing side of him as we see, to nurture a group, even if it was a group that was feeding his ego. This is not faint praise. This is faint praise.
They were all dependent on him. I think it was a dependency culture. I don't think he was nurturing in the lead. I don't think he had a nurturing bone in his body.
But he was.
And for years, I quite liked that about him. I mean, I did. I kind of liked it. You know, it's like it went against the culture. You know, it's like. And it wouldn't be allowed today. It would be a scandal, you know. It's like each day I find a new person I like has been, you know, there's a new scandal about sexual abuse, or, you know, it's like F. Murray Abraham is the latest one. But at the time I quite liked it. Would it be allowed today? Would he be allowed to abuse so many people? I don't know. But, you know, I mean, they were all dependent on him for work to an extent, and it was kind of, it was deeply dysfunctional, as we would now describe it. But I still have a slight suspicion of words like that, of dysfunctional, and, you know, it's like, I think people often choose that, you know, I think a lot of people in his orbit chose that because it was more intense than other orbits, you know. It was like, but again, as I keep saying, it comes back, you can do that when you're young, but could it have gone on like that? I don't think it, any of them. I mean, a lot of them subsequently had really good careers, you know, in...
You make the point that he spent, he seems not to have saved, there was no sense of tomorrow, and yet he didn't buy anything. He didn't accumulate.
No.
He inhaled, for a good tell. But as if he needed to process it. He needed to get the money in and out somehow, yep, rather than either not earn or save, as if they're both forbidden to him, to be lazy or to accumulate.
Yeah, and again, I kind of like that even now, you know, in which we have this neoliberal world in which even, you know, even the most left-wing thing is either even the... is kind of to live a sensible life, you know. Life is much more sensible now. And I do have, even though I've cleaned up myself and even though I recognise the poisonous aspects of him, I still have a slight nostalgia for the fact that someone like him could exist and, you know, could be so vociferous, you know. And it's one thing to have lots of kind of small rock bands or small authors or small left-wing circles being vociferous because only their small circle of people... The thing that was great about Fassbinder, he was incredibly vociferous and left-wing, and he had this huge popular audience, you know. It was, and it was that combination, I think, that was so magnetic, you know.
You quote a headline which is something like, will there be an inundation of proles or something, that he was somehow...
Well, he was great. He was a pro. He's an autodidact, which, you know, I love, and other left-wing, supposedly left-wing filmmakers... would bring out a great film every 6 years or something and do nice interviews. And, you know, I liked the fact that he did it much more kind of like a rock band, putting out singles.
And oh, that does kind of,
seem. Because I think that in itself was kind of went against the grain, but, yeah.
And there is the sense that it's an almost inexhaustible archive and we don't have to watch Bell and Alexander Platt. I saw World on a Wire a few years ago.
Fantastic.
I mean, it is from a book that clearly has the ideas in it and it'd already been filmed, but do you know this at all? The very prescient film about alternate realities,
computers,
about the internet, about everybody living in a computer, in effect, but very nicely made for state television.
And the third generation
as well. In two parts. Third generation, I haven't
seen. Two or three films that are really, you know, and the fact that he was doing it so quickly, you'd think, well, they wouldn't be so prescient, they wouldn't be so considered, but, you know, there was a period when he was really good at that, I think. I still haven't seen everything.
But so that would be on the shortlist, would be the third generation, and you single out Germany in Autumn, his segment of that, even though it's a compound film, sort of commissioned, it's incredibly revealing from the sounds of things.
What, you mean my favourite?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, if people want to start somewhere.
Germany in Autumn is weird because it was a film that was made by, like, I think, 6, 7, 8 different directors. It was like the politics of West Germany in the late 70s. They said, we should do a collective film. I think there'd previously been one in France in 68. And... you know, and a lot of the people there, a lot of the other parts of the film were very considered and very political and very... and a snooze, to be honest. And they make the mistake of opening with Fassbinder. And it's just 20 minutes, like a 20-minute scream almost, you know. It's like... and he just, you know, grabs you and won't let go. And it's the first 20, 25 minutes are just fantastic. And everything else...
So he's fighting with his mother. He's waiting for his drugs to
arrive.
It's all
set in his, you know, it's all set in his flat. I mean, by this point, he was very successful, but it's this horrible, grungy, small flat. And you can smell the cigarette smoke and the sweat. And it's not beautifully decorated or anything, you know. And he's arguing with his lover and having a huge fight with his mum. He phones up and buys drugs and then hears police siren and flushes the drugs down the toilet. He's naked, he's playing with his balls, he's like, you know, he's kind of sweaty and he's just like, you think, and at the time, you know, it's like the idea that this, all the rest of the film is probably more considered in terms of politics and stuff, but it was like the idea that this could be political. And again, that's an ambivalent thing in the book. It's like, to me, that's a turning point almost. It's like, well, it was. I mean, it was stunning to see that. And you think, why haven't I seen anything like this before? And it is, the personal is political and so on, which was a phrase at the time, you know. And then you think, well, it's also a turning point into which people went into the personal as political and drugs and mysticism and, you know, and left the political behind. And it is a problem, I think. It is stunning. It's like, and I hadn't seen it since 1978 or anything. And I looked at it, on YouTube. And it is. It still has that. It's very rare, I think. It still has that incredible energy and pull and...
You inspired me to look it up, but I couldn't find it. I got something called Autumn in Germany, which was very soothing indeed.
Like an ambient spa thing.
You mentioned the cigarette smoke, and I can't help feeling from your description that smoking while watching films was almost as important to you as it was to Fassbinder. You mentioned your last cigarette, but you haven't said it's your final cigarette. Are you still...
I've managed, yeah. I mean, and funnily enough, at the time, I didn't smoke in the 70s, early 80s. I didn't. So it was subsequently. But 18 months, and I still haven't. Yeah.
Well, you deserve a round of applause.
Hypnotherapy, folks, if anyone's still smoking.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Well, you deserve a round of applause anyway, but perhaps we should ask for a question if we've got our rover willing to, if the Mars rover is willing to. Oh, we've got Tom over there. Microphone coming your way, sir.
I guess I have two questions. You talked about how you don't find Berlin Alexanderplatz as the most... close to one of his most successful films, but it strikes me that Effie Briest is such a powerful film, and it's almost the opposite of Deutschland und Herbst, the Germany in Autumn, right? It's unbelievable that the same person makes that film, and then these beautiful monologues, and he does the monologues himself in Effie Briest, right? And I'm just curious, you know, why you think he was drawn to Fontana, you know? I mean, because Fontana is a kind of gentle... ironist of the Prussian state, of curious affinity, and I'm just curious what you make of the affinity between Fontana and Fassbinder. And then my second question is, I love Third Generation as well. How do you, you know, think of somebody like Godard in comparison to Fassbinder? You know, La Chinoise compared to Third Generation, like. Yeah, I'm just curious how you think of them in opposition or you know what your how you kind of compare them in your mind.
Well, to take the second one first, I think I remember from his interviews that Fassbinder had very ambivalent feelings about Godard, and like he loved practically his favorite film ever was Vivre sa vie, which he said he'd seen something like 28 times or something, and But he was very unhappy with other Godard stuff, especially the political stuff. I think the reason he liked Vivre sa vie, which has got a beautiful, I don't know if you remember, it's got a beautiful shot of Anna Karenina in the cinema crying as she watches a film, which he then put in his own film, Veronica Voss. I think he liked that film because it actually had emotion in. I don't think he liked the Godard who was too theory heavy and too kind of dry and so on. I think that feeds into your first question. I think the interesting thing about Effie Briest and Berlin Alexanderplatz is he does the voiceover in both of them and he puts his voice into it. And I think that's partly, again, it's a good thing and a bad thing, I think, is that he's autodidact, as am I. He grew up with films and books that meant an immense amount to him. And when he came to make them, he had to inject himself into them and make them personal. And Effie Briest is definitely the much better work of art, I think, is much more successful because he had more distance from it, I think.
It is pretty much a classical film.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, it's like... and it's also got a woman in it, I think, as a central character. And I think he manages to navigate that thing of being trapped and being claustrophobia in a way that's beautiful, whereas in some of the other films, it's not. It's just trapped and claustrophobic, which it is in Berlin Alexanderplatz, I think. I don't think he had enough distance. If you read interviews with him, you know, he's absolutely obsessed with the... Berlin Alexanderplatz, with a central, with the relationship between the two men in it. And he makes Berlin Alexanderplatz almost about that and leaves out all the other stuff. Whereas in Effie Briest, you get the sense of the society and the trap, you know, and it's like, I think he was too close in Berlin Alexanderplatz, but yeah.
There's a gentleman here. Oh, you're getting a microphone. Mm. We spare no expense. Did
Fassbinder have a consistent visual style?
Well, no, I mean, it changed over, you know, the early stuff was very different. He started in the theatre, and it was a question of arranging people, arranging bodies. I think if you look at the early films, it's very spare, and there wasn't a lot of money, obviously. And then as it goes on, he learns on the job, which is very impressive, I think, you know. And by the end, I mean, if you look at his first film from like 69, I think, 70, which is in black and white and is set in Berlin, a very recognisable street. It's a bunch of young people standing in the street smoking and arguing and it's very... and then you look at his last film, Corel. You can't imagine two more different things, you know. I think he lost something towards the end. I think if you look at Corel, it's like you can see where the money went, and it's kind of very beautifully technically done. But I don't. I think it's become like a jelly.
A cirque, but he didn't really understand what cirque was all about.
I don't know about that. I think they got very friendly, and he interviewed Cirque, and I think at his best, he's very...
Is there a point in Fassbinder's film where the camera becomes a character, if you see what I mean,
I think the precise point is Chinese Roulette, where it becomes... And that's also the film, apparently, where that's where the drugs came in. And it becomes... moving the camera and editing for the sake of it, almost. And it's very claustrophobic, and it's very... again, it's a film I can be obsessed with, but I don't like. It's not a likeable film. It's kind of very... you feel as if you... It's like a paper cut. You feel as if you put your finger on it, you'd draw blood. And whereas with Effie Briest and certain of the other earlier films, and Fear Eats the Soul, it's just, you know, heartbreaking. And in A Year of 13 Moons, which is another one of my favourite films, and these are real people, I think, whereas towards the end, I think, the style became too much and the people got lost, I think. I don't know. Do you like Corel?
I didn't like it. I felt sorry for Jean Moreau, and I felt sorry for Franco Nero, who'd been promised a bigger role in the next film. So that's tough on you that he died.
Yeah.
But I also
it's not a great book.
Yeah. No, it's not a great book. I just remember the French Gay Press, there was a paper called Gay Pied, which is French for a hornet's nest, but spelled differently. And they sold the shirts that Brad Davis wore with the slogan, Querellez-vous? Be your own querelle. Maybe the same as you had the phrase, clean bodybuilder.
I think that's the most effect that film has had. It's been on kind of adverts and,
I didn't like it, but then I know that with gay material, I'm even more impossible in the demands I make on a visual statement because I feel personally involved. I want to be validated but not patronised, and I'll find a way to dislike it one way or another. do you have another question, perhaps? Final question? Yeah. We've answered all questions. Claire, you're obviously a plant. Gentlemen here.
A couple of points I want to kind of argue the toss with you over. One is to do with a kind of sameness about Fassbinder. I think, as has already come out in the questions about things like Effie Brace and Carell, that there's an enormous variety in Fassbinder. And even if there is a similarity in theme around the idea of ultimately of hopelessness, of entrapment, his artistic invention, film after film after film, as you say, average time 100 days, some shot in 20 days, is just, we've seen nothing like this in the history of cinema.
Mm.
And I think that it is true that he was an obsessive filmmaker who went back again and again and again to the same themes. But cinematically, he was endlessly brilliant.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that. I mean, even towards the end, I mean, think Veronica Voss, which is, again, another one of my favourites, was towards... I don't like Carell. There's a number of films towards the end that I don't like, but Veronica Voss, I think, is beautiful. And moving. And I think that was partly... There's a number of variables. One of them is using actors outside his circle and so on. I think he was too comfortable within his little circle.
And I don't think Fassbinder was ever comfortable.
Well, yeah. But I think he was comfortable. That's the problem, I think, partly, is that he was happy being unhappy, you know.
I disagree.
Well, yeah.
Can I just ask one other question, or make one other comment, which is, from a political point of view, I think one of the things that hasn't been perhaps touched upon tonight is that I think if there was a political dimension to him, it was that he was an anarchist. And anarchists are always unhappy because there's nothing really to do with your anarchism except to continuously kind of berate the world and try to find structures, but then again you immediately reject structures because you're an anarchist. And so it's very difficult to kind of get a purchase on any of the things that you are outraged by. But in particular, I'd say that there's a great consistency in Fassbinder's work, and again something that hasn't been mentioned, around what is essentially his revolt against what you might call neo-Nazism. The fact that post-war West Germany was, in his eyes and in the eyes of other left-wing critics, very much perceived as a world reconstructed with the very people who had been part of the old regime. And that is another consistency in his films. Whether the films are overtly political or indirectly political, there is this profound objection to the new West Germany because of its foundations.
Yeah, again, I wouldn't disagree, but I think his politics are very ambivalent and ambiguous, and I think he liked being in the heart of it. I don't think he would have been happy with the Germany that subsequently, more recently, has come to terms more with it and has been a model in a way. I mean, you know, Germany isn't perfect or anything, but I think it's tried in a lot of ways to come to terms with that stuff. That's what I meant about him being happy, being unhappy. I think he... the anarchism as well, again, it's an unanswerable question, but that's one of the reasons I have other people in the book, like Straub Huley and Jenna and people, as alternative, and Alexander Kluger, another West German filmmaker, because they managed to have long, long, long careers and managed to hold on to their political principles and managed to infuse their work with those political principles in a way that... And if you're being really, you know, cruel with Fassbinder, you'd say, well, he didn't. He was too... He liked the glamour of cinema too much. I think there's a quote from one of his friends in it where he said he was Marilyn Monroe. He wanted to be Marilyn Monroe. And he wanted to be Marilyn Monroe of the left or the anarchism or something. He didn't want to do the boring, you know, long... And again, that's, yes, you know, I think it's unanswerable. It's a tension at the heart of him and what makes him magnetic. But is he a good role model for that reason? You know, yeah. It's more like one of those people we all knew in our teenage years who was really magnetic, was really good at bringing people together. Let's do a protest, you know. It's like, whatever, it's like... But then kind of, you know, it all falls apart at a certain point, you know, because there's the boring work to do. Revolution can only be boring, in a sense, patient, boring work each day, you know. I don't think Fassbinder would have been any good at that, but...
I think it's time to say thank you very much to Ian Pamlin for being...
Very good guest. Very good help. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.